Hey everyone, Will Cooper here, host of Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast. Join us as we dive deep into the world of hunting and outdoor pursuits. We've brought together some of the most accomplished individuals in the industry to share their invaluable insights and experiences with you. But here's the kicker. It's not just about hunting tips and tactics. We're exploring how you can carve your own path, elevate your skills, and gain some wisdom from the best in the field. So whether you're a seasoned hunter looking to fine-tune your skills or a newbie eager to learn, our podcast has something for everyone. Stay tuned for more exciting guests and hotter topics. Don't miss out and subscribe to Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast today and start making your mark in the great outdoors.
At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com. Midway USA brand product designers have one straightforward goal: develop high-quality, technically sound products and deliver them to customers at reasonable prices. If you are immersed in the shooting sports industry and pay close attention to every single detail, you know our products are built right and stand up to everyday use. Who has shooting mats and range bag systems to hunting clothing and just about everything for the outdoors? Log on and shop 24/7 with super fast shipping. MidwayUSA.com.
Strain your eyes against the sky and find no trespass for 100 miles. The rubber peeled from your brake to rim, and no sign of wings on southern wind. If the boss is calling and bills are due, but there'll be no chores until you're through. If your boots are east and west or in between, on frozen rock or soggy green. If the birds are calling and smoke is due, and there'll be no rest until you're through. If the treasure you seek is in the hunt, you've arrived at the foul front.
You good to go?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. Got my whiskey right here.
So. Got your twisted tea. I actually have a giant twisted tea down in the car that my wife got. And I thought about drinking it during this, but I don't want to go all the way downstairs and get it. You know, I drink. Anyways. All right. You ready?
Yep. Let's do it.
All right. 3, 2, 1, go. And hello, welcome to another edition of the Foul Front Outdoors Waterfowl Hunting Podcast. Although I don't know how much waterfowl hunting 3/4 of us have been doing versus maybe just Matt. But with that being said, it is just Matt and I tonight. So I think Thomas is actually out shooting things. I don't know if Ben's out shooting stuff. I don't know.
He's not. He's playing dad right now.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I think the things he has been trying to shoot are mostly in the deer side of things.
Ew.
I know, right? Like, I only need to shoot one deer a year personally just to get some venison in the freezer.
Yeah.
And I'm okay. Like, that's after that, I'm really not interested.
That's where I'm at. And for the last few years, I would take off a weekend to go rifle hunting here in Nebraska for deer. This year, I didn't even do that. I took off 2 afternoons. I went goose hunting. Well, I guess the weekend I went back to go rifle hunting, the first day, I got the blind ready. I got our pit blind ready, and I hauled all the decoys out there and got them all filled up and everything. And the next day we hunted it, shot a goose, and then I shot my buck that afternoon or that evening. So, because usually when I'm sitting in the deer blind, I'll be looking up and I'll just see tons and tons of geese and ducks. And I'm like, they know. It's like they know, you know. they're torturing me.
Well, and you live in a pretty good area of the country that has, I would go out on a limb here and say, like, pretty high, decent, better than average quality compared to, like, where I'm from in the east. So, like, out east, I grew up in Tennessee, lived in Georgia, Florida, like, not renowned duck hunting states. And really not even renowned deer hunting states unless you're on like QDMA. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's great places to go and kill deer in Tennessee and in Georgia, but it's not as accessible, I would argue, as if you're like lodged in Nebraska, like you are with all the contacts you have where you could go out for an afternoon and have a decent chance at a pretty decent large buck. You know, I mean, tell me, do you think I'm wrong on that?
Yeah, I mean, let's not pump up Nebraska too much. Like, there's a lot better states out there, like Kansas and South Dakota, North Dakota. If anyone wants to go deer hunting or any hunting, I would recommend going to those states first. No, I'm just kidding, but no,
Nebraska. Stay out of my spot. This is my spot.
I mean, it really is funny. You know, I'll go on these Facebook groups and these forums and stuff, and everyone's there'll be questions like, "What states do you want to hunt most?" And it's always Kansas or Dakotas, and I'm like, "Yes."
Like silently fist pumping, just, like, or yeah. Audibly because Facebook can't hear you yet.
Go to Arkansas. Don't come to Nebraska.
we could talk on that on those Facebook groups, but you know, like, so for me to go deer hunting, the way that, so in Texas it was accessible but really expensive. You know, like the public Texas deer hunting where I was at, San Antonio, was not great. Once again, you kind of have to know people. I had family land I could go deer hunt on, but it was like an hour and a half away, so it was a project to go do it. You know, for me personally, if I don't have, if it's not accessible, then I won't do it very often. And then at that point, I might as well just pay good money and go on a trip. You know, just go on a trip. Yeah. And have one or two really good opportunities, really good experiences. So, you know, up here in Virginia, it's kind of the same way. Like, I don't have terribly great access to a lot of deer hunting that's nearby. My duck lease is actually closer here than it was in Texas, which is nice. But the duck hunting here is it's a little slow. It's really slow.
Well, hey, it's going to look a lot better next year, isn't it?
When I'm not here anymore?
Well, I mean, compared to where you're moving to.
I don't know, man. I got to be honest with you. I see, you know, people up here, they, and you know, you and I talked about wood ducks before. People up here like talk about, oh, you know, I don't want to shoot woodies. And I'm like, I'll sit in a woody swamp all day long. And like, if I shoot three woodies, or I forgot what the limit is in Georgia, I that's a good day. Like, if I could go and reliably shoot two or three ducks, I'm not upset with that. I'm not upset with those numbers. Versus like today, I mean, there's people going out up here right now. And I mean, don't get me wrong, there's places in Virginia people are doing okay. But you know, just so happens where I'm at, like on the coast, east to 95, it just hasn't been cold enough yet. Like, it hasn't pushed enough of the big divers down here to honestly make it worth going out most days. You know, it's like by the time you go through all the pain.
It sounds like that might change for you, though. I've been looking at the long-term forecast or whatever, and it looks like that polar vortex is going to dip in here this next week or so, and it's looking like the East Coast. I don't think it's going to do much for us, except maybe freeze up Canada finally, so we have a week of duck hunting. But it looks like the East Coast is going to finally get some cold weather. Fingers crossed for you guys. But
it'd be nice. But I'll tell you, like, this weekend, I'm hedging my bets. I'm actually going to the Jersey Shore this weekend to go hunt some brant. So I didn't know this, you know, but there is a ton of water. You know, one of the goals about living here has been just getting familiar with the waterfowl culture. There is a ton of waterfowl culture on the Jersey Shore, you know, the Maryland, you know, Chesapeake Bay, obviously, the Tidewater, like, up through Virginia. That Haverty Grace has the decoy museum in it. You know, so I'm going out to the Jersey Shore because they've got brant out there, which I've never even seen a brant in real life. So I'm kind of excited about that.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
And then black ducks. You know, they've got a ton of black ducks there. And they got a ton of black ducks here in Virginia too. I mean, like, I could reasonably go out and shoot a black duck here, even on my lease. It just hasn't, the opportunity hasn't really presented itself for what I've been doing. But, so I'm hedging my bets. I'm going to go north this week, and then I'm going to try to hunt the Chesapeake Bay as well. More to come on that, more to follow. So
nice.
It'll be a good time. But anyways, what are we here talking about today? Now that we've like recapped our last, week of misery.
Well, it's funny you say that here, because in Nebraska it's been pretty stale, and that's kind of segues into what our topic is late season waterfowl hunting. Mm-hmm. And how, I mean, these birds, we'll just preface it real quick here, these birds have seen a lot, more than likely. I mean, you're not typically hunting new birds, you're hunting birds that have been in the area for quite a while, which we are. Think a lot of people across the country are. They're not really moving because there's no cold fronts, there's no snow on the food, so they're not moving south. They're still birds north of us.
Yeah, why would they? Why go anywhere? You know, ducks are like people in a lot of senses. Like, They're only going to go as far as they need to go to get the to get their basics.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, ducks, all animals are lazy, honestly. I mean, when you think about it, they're going to go the point of least resistance. Humans no different than that either, you know, but unless they're forced differently. But ducks, you know, if you don't have to move, geese, if you don't have to move, you can get up and you can fly over this nice cornfield up in North Dakota or Alberta or Saskatchewan or whatever. Why would you fly hundreds of miles south to do the same thing if you don't have to? Cold temps, they don't really care.
Now, some birds, though, you know, there are birds out there, and you can see it through the banding. You know, I love seeing people post their band stuff on Facebook. You know, some birds are kind of like teal, for example. Like teal, they get a whiff of cold air, and they can't get south fast enough. You know, they beeline to the coast. And there's members of every population. I mean, that's why, like, my buddies in Texas are cleaning up down on the coast. You know, they're doing great. You know, so there are populations of birds that are automatics. You know, they're going to go as far as they can. But there's a good deal of the other ones, too, that are just not going to go. You know, where they're not going to go. And late season, it does bring about a unique set of challenges that I think, you know, hunters, in order to continue to be successful, have to adapt to those things and realize that when you're hunting early season birds, they're going to be a little bit different than mid, and they're going to be a little bit different than late season, especially if your weather's changing, you know. So it's a great topic. I'm excited about it. So what's the first thing in the hopper?
So the first thing is, and this is typically assuming it's a colder year than now, you know, assuming most of the ducks and geese by now have reached at least Nebraska, if not Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas areas, find open water, find those hidden spots. So what I mean by that is if you're froze up, find those warm water sloughs, find those heated ponds, quotation marks, that people like to claim we have up here. Find those spots that are open waters that can allow birds to still roost in your area and, you know, kind of a headquarters for them. And then they can go and feed and find areas. You find those areas, you're going to find the birds. The hidden spots I'm talking about as well. Even if you're not froze up, you want to find spots that are unpressured. So this could be a property that maybe you have access to that hasn't been hunted all year. I know that's pretty much looking for a unicorn. It could be some public ground that for whatever reason has been inaccessible until late season. It could be, I mean, there's no limit of things. As things freeze up, especially rivers and creeks and stuff, there's going to be little pockets of open water. The birds either keep them open, springs keep them open, whatever. You find those areas, you're going to have a better chance of finding birds.
Yeah, and another important note on this, you know, you mentioned roosts. I would say scouting in this sense also gets very important when you're looking to see where birds are roosting. You know, so if you got like truly big water, big reservoirs and stuff like that, your ability to go out and hunt where they're roosting is probably be fairly limited. But I'd be very careful to see, you know, if you've got a big pond or something in open water, like I know here, the guys that I hunt with up here, they're very diligent about spot rotation. Like they won't go and they won't hammer. Like it's a mortal sin to hunt the roost here because that's what runs, you know, like that, then the ducks are not coming back. Like you're going to push them off. And if you hunt the roost, yeah. So, you know, I would say just be cognizant when you're scouting out here, you know, those spots where they're going to feed, those spots where they're going to roost. You know, for as much as you can see it. Now, just keep in mind that if you only got, you know, if you're going to go roost shoot, you might get one, maybe two, you know, shoots off that thing. And then chances are good they're not coming back to that spot again if they're resting there and there's not food. So just pay attention to that, especially in late season if you're getting somewhere that's icy and your water's starting to get limited as much as you can. I just say keep it in the back of your mind. You go shoot a roost. That'll sometimes get you disinvited with your buddies that invited you. And two, you may only have one or two good hunts. Now, if it's the last day of the season, you can knock yourself out. So,
yeah, we can tie scouting back into this. You know, if you can locate the roost, if you can locate the feeds and the loaf areas, which I mean, it's not much different than typical scouting. It's just can be a little easier because there's less places for them to go. You know, they're either sitting on moving water that's open or big reservoirs that still have open water in the middle somewhere. Typically, at least in my area, I mean, it varies from area to area. But what you want to look for out there when you're scouting, like on rivers and creeks and sloughs and whatnot for the roost spots or just areas where they've been, is you want to look for tracks, scat, feathers, live birds, just all, you know, I mean, typical scouting stuff, but it bears reiterating here, going for late season as well.
Sure. Yeah, for you guys where it gets real cold, you know, in the south, it never, you know, where I hunted In Texas, it never really froze up. You know, the whole lake stayed open. But what did change, so for some of you that are on like reservoirs with flood control, they're going to start drawing the lakes down right now, you know, for the spring rains. So that might be changing up where you're looking. I know like where I grew up, they would pull the lakes down like 6-7 feet, which would really change kind of the what it would open up. And sometimes it opened up some food, sometimes it wouldn't, but it could change your spot geography quite a bit. So kind of bear that in mind too, if you're hunting those lakes. And a lot of you that are, you know, lived there before, you're familiar with this. Those of you that might be moving to areas, you know, if you're hunting on a flood control reservoir, it might start changing up. So that's pretty much, you know, as far as I've got on the water and the scouting and everything, just kind of keeping in mind the freezing temperatures. And if you've got ice eaters, put them out.
Yeah. Let's move on. So late season, another thing that can really help you, as we've said, you know, the birds are going to be super pressured, typically super educated. One thing that can even the playing field for you is the weather. Typically you want to look and see what the forecast looks like. If it looks like this year, you're going to be cursing the weatherman, but, things you want to look for is just changes in the weather. Like for instance, today here in Nebraska, it was 64 degrees. Tomorrow it's going to be a high of 40 with almost 60 mile an hour northwest winds. So tip, yes, I am going hunting tomorrow, but, you want to look for those changes in the weather. That'll make the birds do something different, especially if there's precipitation or thick cloud cover like fog or snow. Especially, I love my snow hunts, especially if you mix them in with wind. Those birds, when they get up, they want to come and they want to look around. They want to dump in quicker. It helps convince them. Plus, it's a lot easier to hide a lot of stuff in the snow. Just the change in the weather really can get the birds in a lot better mood to land and decoy and work compared to sunny and still or light winds that the January thaw can have.
I definitely get more excited about hunting. You know, most of us can't control the days that we can and can't hunt. You know, like you pretty much have your Saturday or you have your Sunday, or if you're in places like where I'm at, you don't even have Sunday on public land. So, yeah. You know, you get your one day a week to get out. But, you know, I will say, like, if it's been, like, if there's going to be that cold front, there's going to be that weather coming in, I get pretty excited about, especially the low clouds, like you said, because it's going to keep them moving around. Not that much different than, you know, early season. But I will say the big thing in late season, especially if you get a good cold push that comes through, locks up some water up north, you're going to start seeing new birds. And if you combine that with, like, that low overcast day, then it's probably going to sum up to be a really good shoot for you.
Yeah. And I guess another thing that we could add is if it's been, you know, in a typical year, it'll be cold in January, but there is a thing called a January thaw. And typically that'll lead to what we call is a reverse migration, wherein birds that have already migrated through your area will come back up. Now, have those birds been through your area once this year? Yes. But are they fairly new back to the area? Also, yes. So basically you're hunting, I guess the birds don't really get as educated moving down. I mean, to a point they do, they understand decoy spreads and, you know, spinners and whatnot, but it's when they're new to an area, they don't realize what are safe areas, like what are refuges and what are not. So that's kind of what the difference is. I mean, yeah, they're smarter birds. They hear bad calling. They hear, you know, they recognize, your lack of concealment. They recognize decoy spread patterns and whatnot. But when they come back into a new area they haven't been to for weeks, just that little change can be the impetus for them coming into your spread.
Yeah, and it's, you know, you mentioned something in there too about how they recognize bad calling. And I think that the calling, you know, I don't know, do you have anything else to add on the water piece before we move on to that?
On the weather? No, I mean, you can't really control it, especially if you have limited vacation days. You can only hunt the weekends or whatnot. But if you can hunt those, what some people consider bad weather days, thick fog, high winds, snow, freezing rain, sleet, those are probably going to be your better days. It's going to, you know, it'll make those birds kind of more likely to dump in your spread. Yeah. But let's transition over to the calling now, because that is a big part of late season hunting. That leads us into our next tip, actually, Alex, if you want to.
Yeah. So that's probably my biggest, I make two major changes. When I, you know, firmly transition over to late season is what I'll call it. You know, usually for me, it depends on the splits. You know, I would say if you've got a first split, that's what I consider to be early season. When the second split opens up, I would say for when the second split opens till about Christmas and the first of the year, that's when I start to consider like kind of their midseason. And then after that, everything after is in my book kind of starting to get late season. You know, about this point in January to the close of the season, you're starting to get late. And this is the point where I really start experimenting a little bit more with my calling, specifically the reduction of calling. More often than not, and really, you know, last year when I would take people out, I used to only bring my whistle with me. I would only bring my pintail whistle, you know, or my 3-in-1. And I would hardly ever touch a mallard call for anything, you know, or, you know, a regular duck call, because I noticed that I was far more successful sounding a little bit different, you know, and being a lot more subtle. And just one, it's, you know, how does that saying go? Like, you know, keep your mouth shut and let everybody think you're a fool as opposed to opening it and confirming it. It's kind of the same way, kind of the same way in duck hunting, you know. Like I think it's more often better to err on the side of not calling as much or not at all, and just watch and be a lot more attentive to what you're seeing the birds respond to versus going out there and cracking on those calls like you would maybe earlier in the season. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
No, I mean, you basically hit the nail on the head here, and you hit a lot of points. I'm going to address one main one though, is be different. Okay, these birds, especially early season, mid season, people are just hammering on hail calls. They listen to those competition callers. That's not what a duck sounds like. You know, you don't just hammer on. You don't get super aggressive with them. That's, if you want to listen and know what actual birds sound like, go out, sit out in the marsh at 4 a.m., 3 a.m., whatever, and just listen. Don't even throw decoys out. Don't do anything else. Just listen. You can do it before duck season. You can do it after duck season closes. But that will tell you how actual birds sound like if you know where they're at, actually. But going off of that, yeah, ease up. You know, I do the same thing. You lay off the calls. The only thing you really do the mallard calls for, at least what I use them for, is the comeback. You know, if they're going away, what are you going to lose? Give them a little comeback. A lot of times you can hook them back in there, especially if it's a single drake. If the other one I like is the whistle. I love the whistle. Teal whistle, drake whistle. A lot of people don't utilize it. They don't utilize it as enough. If a lot of people would just shut up, put the regular duck call away, and just utilize the whistle, I think they would kill more ducks. Or not use a call at all, honestly. There's nothing wrong with going quiet, especially late season, because these birds are pressured. They're spooky, especially if there's not a lot of wind that day, sunny or cloudy. I guess it doesn't really matter. Cloudy days, it's easier for them to pick you out. But they're really spooky, and when you're calling, it gives them a place to kind of key in on. They can look down and be like, oh, I see this darker blob in this pile of cattails or tule leaves or whatever. That's obviously a person, and this is a hunter spread, so I'm going to keep flying.
Well, not if you've got Optifade on.
No. Oh my gosh, don't even.
No, but you know, so I use a high roller. So, you know, I bought a, you know, I've tried a lot of different whistles out. You know, I've tried the Duck Commander whistle. I even have a, you know, up here, I was looking on my shelf. I've got a old wooden pintail whistle up here on my call shelf and another, like a Haydel or something like that. But I found that I like the high roller because it has, I don't know if you ever used that one. To me, it does a really good pintail because it literally has a little roller, almost like, you know, your coach's whistle, which, by the way, if you don't have a whistle, you got a dog or you got a, you know, regular like sporting whistle, that'll work just fine. In fact, yeah, go that way. The way I'll start off with the whistle, especially is if I'm trying to get their attention, is I'll just go with the highest pitch one I've got, like a highest pitch teal peep, peep, peep. And you know, most of the time they hear that. And then, you know, if they get in a little bit closer, if I have a bird that's working closer, but you know, maybe isn't picking me out because I'm in a little bit more dense cover or my spot's pretty small, then I'll just kind of go to the regular teal or even a mallard drake. You know, if you get pretty good on those whistles, you can do, you know, several different species of ducks. And I found that to be pretty effective. Another thing outside of the whistle is just use one of your teal calls, one of those high pitched, you know, peep and teal calls, the one that's not the whistle. I forget which one that is, if it was the green or the blue wing. I get them. To me,
typically they're blue wing, I think.
Yeah, blue wing. That's it. You can use a blue wing talk because you sound different. You know, a lot of people put those things up at the end of teal season. They don't touch them again. Hey, guys, a lot of teal are still flying around out there, and ducks will respond to that too. And so it sounds different. It sounds like a duck, and it's something that that they will recognize and has worked for me. And like I said, it blew clients' minds when I wouldn't have a mallard call on my lanyard this time of year.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, it goes back to trying to be as realistic as possible or not being, like you said, you know, open your mouth or what it was, shut up and let them think you're an idiot, open your mouth and confirm it or whatnot.
Yeah.
I mean, that, it really does go into that. And I guess we'll transition here with the realism aspect. We'll go into decoy spread here.
Ooh. Big change number two for me.
Big change. That's right. So now I know you guys don't know what mallards are over there in the Atlantic Flyway, but where we have
a lot of greenheads over here.
Really?
Yeah. So I was actually, there's more greenheads. I've seen more greenheads here than I've seen, down in Texas, the old part of Texas I was hunting.
Don't be telling people that now. They're going to start complaining.
Oh, that's a good point. Sorry. No greenheads in Virginia.
No mallards in the Atlantic Flyway. But
yeah.
In the Central Flyway, where we still have mallards, I like to typically, you know, it's late season. The breeding season is coming up on us. So these birds are starting to pair up or are already paired up, you know, typically. They're already paired up. So what I like to do in my spread is I'll – either run a really small spread, you know, 6-12 decoys max. I'll grab a hen and a drake, set those right next to each other, go down a little bit, another hen and a drake, maybe have another drake chase, like they're kind of fighting for her, and then just keep doing that, especially if it's in like small water, a heated slough or something like that, like a little creek.
Those heated sloughs you've got up there are nice.
Yeah, they're pretty nice. I mean, we got to turn the thermometer up every now and then, but...
What's really nice is you drain those heated sloughs and get that standing corn in them too. It's amazing.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's the secret.
So I will say, I don't know about you. I actually have decoys. I have set aside for late season. I have a set of, well, up until just the other day I was running, I had a dozen, flocked avian magnum mallards, like the big guys. They do not go out during the regular season. They stay like in their slot bag. These are the only deeks, by the way, that I keep in a slot bag are my late seasons. And they're the cleanest, freshest looking ones. And they're a little bit bigger because I will run no more than a dozen at a time. I have recently transitioned in the spirit of the East Coast over to LL Bean Coastal Magnum Corks, decoys, even though they're a lot bigger. And they stay in a slot bag, but that's more from a heritage standpoint, you know, from an effective standpoint. But I have seen, you know, if you know, this is a time of a season where if you've been out a lot, your deeks that your regular gunners are probably pretty beat up. And they're probably starting to have some mud on them, or they're probably starting to get a little bit dingy or paint's chipping. This is where you get those fresh decoys out and maybe you look a little bit more real than the guy next to you in the slough. So, I don't know. Do you have a late season set?
I mean, not really. I mean, I guess kind of. You know, early season, I don't run most of my mallards, and what I'm running are Avian X. I got a couple of varieties. I got like a Rester Sleeper series, and then I think they're called Backwater series. That basically look like they're feeders.
Yeah.
So I'll run those every now and then, starting about mid season. But those are typically all I run, and I'll throw in maybe some teal or a pintail here and there. I don't have any that I save back, but that is a good point. You know, you want your best looking deeks late season because, like we've said, these birds are educated. They've seen pretty much everything in the book. So you've got to rewrite the book on them and, you know, give them your best, honestly.
Yeah, and that's the term, you know, the term I've heard, you know, that they use, at least for the diver spreads, is you got your gunners, you got your gunning decoys, you know, the ones that are just the working birds that go out there, and they look the part, too, by the end of the season. You know, when I was in Texas, my puddle duck spread, this is, you know, I would have, those avians were the ones I kept back, those flocked in the bag. But, you know, we didn't have a lot of mallards. You know, I kept mallards in my spread for color, but what I had in Texas was an assortment of pintails. So I kept pintails, which are nice and bright, and they had the bigger ones set aside. I had some widgeons for the same reason. The teal, you know, honestly, I can't say that I chucked a whole lot of teal this time of year because in Texas. Now, they're still around, but teal will come to big ducks just as much as they'll go to themselves. And so I would filter the teal out, and then I really ran – and I had some gadwall. I had some big Dakota Magnum gadwall that were flocked as well. No, they weren't flocked. They were, you know, the big guys. And I kept like a dozen of them on the boat, and that was what I ran. And they were pretty looking deeks. I stepped up to the Magnum size too, because since I figured since I'm not having to carry a ton of them in a bag and I'm carrying fewer decoys, then I'll make up for a little bit with the size and the visibility. And that's, you know, I don't know if you've seen these LL Bean Coastal Corks. These things are giant. Like they look like a mini goose. I mean, honestly, they're almost like a goose decoy with a duck head on them.
I'm gonna look them up real quick.
Oh, yeah. LL
Bean Coastal Cork.
Yeah. I mean, the pictures online don't do them the same justice, but this is my Myers. If you guys haven't seen Myers, these things are, they're big. This is like next to my head, you know, it's giant. Yeah. So the coastal corks are bigger than these. They're bigger than a Herder 72.
Dang.
And so they look good on the water and they, you know, they really stand out. And then if you're only running, and here's the thing, if you're a walk-in hunter and you're only going to bring a dozen this time of year, then step it up to a dozen bigger deeks if you can swing it, or keep an eye out for them. If you see them on sale, especially here in about a month, everything will be on sale and you can pick up some decoys really cheap. So that's my technique. It's worked for me in the past. I expect it will continue to work for me. So yeah, there you go.
So I'll tell you, when I'm hunting, so we mentioned smaller spreads. That's not the only way to get late season birds. Sometimes you can go big spreads, but I don't use duck decoys for that. I'll use a few, but what I really like is to mix geese in and a lot of geese. So I'll take two dozen shells. Last week I just did this. I should have had a limit if I could have hit the broadside of a barn, but I ended with a goose and four ducks. Story for another day. But five dozen silhouettes I took out, and then about a dozen sleeper shells and a couple goose floaters, and I mixed them in with about a dozen and a half duck decoys, and the ducks loved it with zero wind, mind you. No wind, cloudy, overcast day, literally the worst conditions you could duck hunt in late season, and still shot four ducks and a goose.
Yeah, I've definitely heard, you know, some people say that the goose decoy is the original Magnum duck decoy. So, yeah, I mean, that's something that I've seen up here a lot of people run, you know, a few dozen, you know, or a half dozen or a dozen geese in their spread. If you got to carry it, if you're walking in, I'll tell you, like, I used to keep a couple of spec decoys for the same reason in Texas, even though, like, I never once decoyed a spec where I hunted, but I kept them there. I shot specs there, but not over my own spreads. You know, they weren't just really going to where I was at, but I kept them in the spread and they worked, you know, at least for the visibility purpose. But yeah, I've heard that, you know, every duck loves a goose decoy because geese are just more wary. You know, the science, from what I understand, the science, quote unquote, behind that is, you know, geese are a lot more wary about where they're going to go. And so they're almost like the automatic security for a duck. Like a duck knows that if there's a flock of geese sitting around, that they're probably a pretty safe area. And for those of you that haven't seen it, like, you know, geese are pretty aggressive towards anything that comes around them anyway. So, yeah. I mean, if I was a duck, that'd make sense.
Yep. So, you can mix it up too other ways. If you got swans in your area, I mean, those are huge. I mean, you talk about visibility, you talk about a Magnum decoy. That's like a triple X super Magnum decoy right there.
Yeah. The swan decoys. So like I've seen a few of those up here and those things they're ginormous. And swans are, so they're like the closest thing I can imagine, like shooting a B-52, like watching one of those. I was out in the blind. There was a guy that I hunted with about 2 weeks ago or so. He had a swan tag. I didn't get a swan tag this year. He had a swan tag to fill and we put out a couple of big swan decoys. And about two, it was a heartbreaker. 2 minutes before shooting light, these two just bomber swans just come in like right straight at the blind. And they're, those birds are so huge. Like if you guys looked up pictures of them, for those of you that are listening, like go, just go look at a hunter that's filled a swan tag. They're bigger than crane. I mean, they're huge birds.
Yeah.
But yeah, their decoys are super visible. And just like geese, they're a very wary bird on the, on their own. And ducks find security in birds like that. They're almost like built-in confidence decoys.
Yeah, you just, I mean, it's late season. You got to throw everything at the wall and see what sticks, honestly. But there are tip, you know, there are scouting plays a huge part of it as well. But another thing that can really help you late season, especially if you're hunting a pond or a lake or something and it's completely froze up, but there are those warm water areas around, that moving water around where those birds are roosting, so they're going to fly over those frozen areas, is busting an ice hole. And that's our next one here.
Well, one other thing, you know, we mentioned this before we leave the decoy thing. This time of year, if you haven't already parked your spinner or the batteries have run out, I can't say that I've ever used a spinning decoy after January 1st.
I can say that. I'll go off on this here in a little bit. I can say that only in the thickest stuff, I guess, would it be my best way. It's that thick weather, the snow, the fog. Sure. It just adds a little visibility, helps them key in on your spread. But yeah, late season, they've seen those spinners. I don't like them too much.
So I had this technique. I was hunting like in a pretty small, you know, so we talked about going to small, you know, more concealed holes here. And the spot that I would hunt in late season last year was one of those places. It was probably no more than like 20, maybe 20 yards by 20 yards. And it was set back in some pretty thick brush, you know, like a timber type brush. So what I did is actually carried some paracord, and those flock of flickers, I would string a flock of flicker up in a tree, like throw a weight over and then pull the flock of flicker up to the top of the tree. And that worked. It was like a little signal beacon. And I like, and the reason why I like the flock of flickers for this is because they have the automatic timer on them where they turn themselves on and off, you know, they space out their actions. Yeah. So it's not just this beacon that's up in a tree, but that worked out really well for me if I was buried in one of those places. And I just carried the one, no mojo in the spread, but just the flock of flicker in a tree, and it would pull birds. It worked. So something you might give a try to late season if you're hunting in a dense, you know, spot like that.
Yeah. So back to the ice hole, though. This can be some of the best hunt, like some of the best hunts, goose and duck, I've ever had have been over ice holes. You take an axe, you chop them out, chainsaw. I know some guys use ice eaters. You can, however you keep it open, hunting an ice hole can be very rewarding, especially if there's birds still in the area. I mean, and that's key. If everything else is froze and you're not seeing birds, honestly, I wouldn't waste your time making an ice hole, because if there's no birds flying over it, what are you going to decoy? But if there's birds in the area, especially, I mean, November, early December these days, when it first caps up, you know, you get an inch of ice or whatever, busting that out, there's still usually birds around. That can be lights out, like I just said. When you're doing this, though, you want to make sure you don't have like a lot of chunks of ice both on top of the water, and you don't want them floating in the water. It just looks unnatural. You want it to look as natural as possible. And what I mean by that is you want smooth edges. You don't want jagged edges. You don't want jagged chunks sitting on top of the ice, especially on a sunny day. That just shines like a mirror. Those birds can see that. And like, that looks really weird. So, you know, if you can take a rake or something and rake those chunks up, try to keep the ice in one big sheet and slide it underneath the other ice chunks. There's a lot of different ways you can do it, but, or break it up a couple of days early. And then if it's supposed to warm up a little bit, just let it melt out and it'll naturally smooth back out. We've done all those to great success.
Well, so as the resident below the Mason-Dixon line hunter here, I've never dealt with ice holes. Like it's never been a problem for me. But I do know guys up here that, you know, have hunted them. And one of the things I've heard them say is like, when they go out and scout, if they found a good hole, they'll break the ice up earlier. And then if they've got an ice eater, they use homemade ice eaters on old trolling motors, which I've looked on Facebook Marketplace. You can get an old trolling motor, like pretty inexpensive. And yeah, there's plenty of online plans to jerry rig one to run off a deep cycle battery. They'll put the ice heaters out like the day before just to keep the hole clean and clean up some of those edges you're talking about. So that's, you know, techniques that I've heard secondhand. I've never had to worry about it, but I will say, you know, in the South, that we start seeing a little bit more water will come in if it's, we've gotten heavy rains down here and like flooding out different spots. So almost I run into the opposite problem where I've got more water than maybe I used to, but no, that's interesting. Hopefully one of these days I'll get to go do one of these like famed ice hole hunts.
Well, I'm telling you, when you can do it, the best way to do it is to put, yes, to bring full bodies or shells out and throw them on the ice, because nothing looks better to birds. I mean, you look at birds on frozen lakes where there might be a hole, there's a lot of them usually sleeping on the ice. They're just sitting, chilling on the ice, walking around, ducks and geese. And then there'll be some, you know, you want a mix of floaters and then whatever else on the ice. And you can even, I've even ran silhouettes on the ice. All you got to do is, you know, rubber mallet, tap them in. Obviously, you want to make sure the ice is thick enough. But other than that, I mean, it just looks so natural. Birds just, for whatever reason, I mean, they find this open water, they want to go to the open water. And if they can go chill out on the edge, like, it's basically a swimming pool for ducks and geese, the swimming pool, you know, they want to hang out there with their buddies and they want to splish and splash in the water and then go tan on the ice shelf.
I mean, if I thought about it from the perspective of an animal that's like, likes to be able to see what's around him, then an ice hole sounds pretty safe, right? Like if I've got this hole in the ice and there's not a bush within 100 yards of me, I probably gonna feel pretty good about something not running out and grabbing me. So, I mean, I could see the appeal.
I mean, yeah, and typically, well, I mean, you're not usually going to set out 100 yards away from a bush. You got to have a hide. I know some guys will take layout blinds with snow covers if there's snow on the ice or if the ice is really white, and they'll lay out like that. Some guys I know have even drug trees out on the ice and made a temporary blind, like kind of lay out with cedar trees and whatnot out there. And they've had great success with that too. Other guys, you know, like I usually when I do it, I just bust a hole right along the edge and then just really, really work on my hide, which I guess we can talk about that next. Look at that. That just worked out great.
Whew, man, excellent transition. It's like you practiced.
I know. Concealment. Concealment late season is key. This is probably the one tip that will make or break your hunts more often than not. If you are not concealed, and by concealed, I mean everything. You don't want, I mean, I don't want anything that doesn't look natural, that doesn't blend in to even, because birds can pick it up. They can pick up the shine off a shotgun barrel, the shine off a GoPro camera, whatever. They will pick it out, especially on a sunny day, on a cloudy day where there's no shadow and they can look right in. They'll pick you out even faster. So you want to be as concealed as possible. And that doesn't mean just lay out with your camo, with your Sitka or whatever camo you have on in some cattails. No, you want top cover, you want front cover, back cover, everything. You cannot be camoed enough during late season.
Yeah, so one of the things I did, still do in the boat, I carry three different cans of Rust-Oleum, the camo ultra flat. And I, you know, I can't say that I originated this tip. I actually got it off of one of the very early Duck Commander episodes, to credit this appropriately. But if it shines, it gets sprayed. Doesn't matter what it is. I mean, I keep, you know, I'll bring, my favorite color, honestly, is their olive drab green. It seems to like match into anything. Like olive green's not really ever out of place. And so, you know, I hit anything that shines on the boat, my gear, everything in my duck spread, or everything, every part of my duck hunting, to include my boat and my motor and all the things, is basically designed to be hit with Rust-Oleum Ultra Flat camo. Like there is nothing on that boat, minus maybe my depth finder, that I'm not going to spray with that camouflage. And so one of the best things to do with your concealment, especially if you're building a blind, and if you're out with other people, it helps to do this as well. Set your blind up, and let's say you shoot a duck. I recommend at least one time during your hunt, preferably early, that you walk out, you know, especially if you don't have a dog, you're going to do this anyway, walk out and take a look back from a distance of about 20 to 25 yards and see what you see in your own hide, and your own blind spot. And it's kind of amazing because you sit there and you'll think, like, I'm very concealed. I feel good about my concealment. I've got all my stuff here. But then you walk back and you look and you're like, oh my gosh, I could see my thermos. Never would, you know, I thought that was concealed. Mine sprayed ultra flat olive green. So,
Like another instance, this is just happened to me last weekend, actually. So I built this little temporary blind out of bushes and like trees and stuff out here on this hunting spot I was at. And I had it walled up across, like you couldn't see my silhouette. All I had was a hole for me to shoot in. And I had a few ducks. If they came straight in and low, they would come right in. If they would circle and I didn't move, I would have shooting opportunities, but they weren't ideal. And more often than not, if they came right above, they would flare off. They keep circling, and then they'd come back over me and flare off. Well, I mean, it's hard to do. What do you do? Do you want to limit your shooting opportunities, or do you want to be, you know, expertly concealed? I chose the latter. I went out, found basically a giant tumbleweed, and covered the whole shooting hole. I could see through the little sticks of the tumbleweed. The birds could not see into me. Basically, what I ended up doing the rest of the hunt is these singles and pairs would circle. They'd circle once or twice, come right in, land, and then I'd one hand push the tumbleweed, like just launch this thing and pull up and shoot them as they were flushing off the water. And I mean, I got two, could have shot another hen like that. So, I mean, it worked, but ideally I would like to shoot them when they're cupping in. But sometimes, you know, you got to think outside the box. Is it better to jump them off the water? Or, I mean, some people probably would just water swat them, honestly, because could have probably done that through my blind. But is it better to have a flushing shot versus a cupping in shot? You might not even get those cupping in shots unless you're expertly concealed.
Yeah. I carry, you know, the other thing that I kept in my boat was camo netting. You know, I picked up the good.
Yeah.
There is good and there is bad camo netting, by the way. And I picked up some of the good stuff. And I did, you know, a lot of times you got to check it. If you're going to get camo netting, you know, you can usually find it. Army surplus stores will have it sometimes. What I'd say is check, army surplus stores, honestly, have what I would consider to be the most durable and the best stuff. But you got to make sure that they don't have the little metal brads on it, you know, that you could see where sometimes they've crimped it together. Those metal brads will shine. But I kept a lot of camo netting in and concealed with that, you know, if, like if there's a hole, throw some camo netting and then some branches over it, just kind of break that outline up. But that's a really useful tool. I know some folks like burlap. The problem I have with burlap is that it doesn't like to stick to things. You know, like if you have a piece of camo netting, like you could pretty much hang it from anything that bristles with a branch. Burlap, not really. You have to carry some zip ties or some other means that means you got to clean it up at the end of the day. Where camo netting, you just kind of drape it over stuff and it'll hold. So I always kept I used to hide my 18-foot boat completely with camo netting and throw branches over it. So I had a lot of it around. You know, now the blinds I hunt with actually have boat hides. It's pretty convenient. They build boat blinds that you just pull into like a garage. But I still have a lot of that camo netting that if I were to walk in, I'd carry with me. So just something to keep in mind and keep in your trick. The other thing to be cognizant of is your shot shells. If you're shooting those bright, you know, if you're 28 gauge, I forgot what color 28 gauge is, but 20 gauge, red, 20, you know, 20 gauge are usually yellow. You 16 gaugers with your purple hulls out there might be a little bit lucky. But most of us are shooting these red shells. You know, if you're shooting a semi-auto and it's chucking them way out of the blind and you've done a lot of shooting, like you might want to go pick some of those up because you're going to just have a big red flag out on the ice.
And that's another, I mean, people should pick up their shells regardless, but that's another reason to pick up your shells, especially on a sunny day, because that brass is going to shine. Yeah. And if you've been shooting a lot, it's going to shine a lot. And that does not look natural. And that's just one more thing for them to flare off of.
Yeah. But I normally wouldn't even bring up picking up your shells in a hunt or during the hunt. I always pick them up after. But late season, I guess I've noticed it matters a little bit more.
Yep. And I guess we're almost done here. We're kind of into the other category now, I guess. You know, we can't really preach concealment enough. That honestly, if you take one thing away from this podcast, is you want to be expertly hidden.
Okay. We have a whole episode on concealment that we did last year that I would consider to be a fairly timeless one that Ben and I did, where we talk about all the different concealment techniques we've used too. So if that's something you want to learn more about, you can go back in our log and check that.
Yep. But now, like I said, now we're into kind of the other. It doesn't really fit into any particular category. It's just kind of quick tips here. So I'll just knock them out real quick. One, dress warm, wear layers, kind of basic knowledge. But late season, typically you can be, it can be super cold. I've hunted in temps of negative 20 before, negative 20 degrees Fahrenheit. And sometimes it can be super warm, or it can be cold and then warm up early in the morning. So you want to wear those layers so you can shed them. Otherwise, if you wear a coat, a super heavy coat, you might get too cold, might be too hot. And you don't want to put all them layers on first thing in the morning if you have to do a lot of work. If you haul out, if you have to walk a mile or something, pulling a decoy sled or a cart or something full of decoys, you're going to sweat a lot. So you don't want to get chilled early on. Just wear your sweatshirt first on, something like that. Next up, and this is an important one, it's really easy to do when it's cold out like it is late season typically, stay hydrated. It's really easy, especially you drinking a lot of coffee, energy drinks, whatever. It's really easy to get dehydrated. It's cold, you don't think you're as thirsty as you are. You lose a lot of water, especially if you're, like I just said, packing in a long ways, chasing after ducks, chasing decoys, whatever, even just being in the cold. You're going to get dehydrated. So make sure you're drinking plenty of fluids. It'll just save you a lot of troubles in the long run. And finally, and this is probably this probably could have been a whole nother tip on its own. Keep your gun clean and know which lubricants to use. Like, for example, don't use Rim Oil. I'm not trying to put them on blast, but when it gets below a certain temperature, that stuff gels up and it will make it so your firing pin doesn't go through and you barely put an indent into the primer of your shells. And I have video proof of this happening because I was an idiot and used Rim Oil and it was cold and it did that.
So I keep a couple of things in my duck bag. I keep some Hops Gun Medic. By the way, that Gun Medic's some pretty like vicious stuff as far as what it'll clean and break, but it's great. I mean, it'll really do the trick. I keep that, and I keep CLP. I'm a big believer in CLP. It's never let me down, so I keep CLP in my bag. Just bought a fresh can the other day of the good stuff. This is the time of year, if you're like me and you shoot Brownings and they'll chew up whatever you want for as long as you want them to, and this is, the time probably would be good to go bring your gun in, strip it down, give it a good cleaning, before you start your second half of the season, because it's probably taken some abuse up to this point. And the combination of cold along with the congealing of your lubricants, then it can add to be, add up to be something that's results in shells not doing their job. Before we leave, though, I am going to bring up one other thing, and it's very near and dear to my heart. In fact, the first episode of the Foul Front Outdoors I ever did was with regards to safety. Late season duck hunting safety can't be overemphasized. Most of us probably started off the season with it maybe being a little bit warmer. Guys, the margin of error, guys and gals, the margin of error now is pretty well gone for most of us all over the country. For water, is all cold. Hypothermia sets in really fast. You really have to be cognizant. You mentioned, we talked a lot about ice. I'd say if you were unfamiliar with hunting on ice or creating ice holes, that you find somebody that is, because that's not something that I would want to go learn solo unless you've just grown up around it. Safety can't be overemphasized here. You mentioned the layers. Don't wear cotton under your waders. Don't wear cotton undershirts if you can at all help it. If you're going to be in a place where you might get soaked and you're going to be a little ways from help, because it's the time of year where, like I said, that margin of error is gone now, and it's really cold where a lot of us are hunting. Go look at the news. You can hit the Google. We've already lost, I'd say, at least a half dozen, if not more, duck hunters this year already. Don't be overloading your boats. This is not the time to be pushing any kind of limits. Not that any time ever is, but I'd say that during early teal season, you have a lot more margin of error than you do in January. And I'd say 90% of the kind of country right now. So go check out that safety episode that we did as well. Take that to heart. I would, I tell you, I carry in my shooting vest. So I have a Delta wading vest that has pockets and stuff on it that I wear. I do keep a fire starter on it. I do keep safety matches. I carry a little torch lighter, and I carry an emergency blanket. You know, those are some things that in a pinch will hold you over until help gets there in the event the worst thing happens. I also carry a flare and a whistle in my pocket, in my vest, you know, for those times. So keep that in mind. That's kind of what my parting shot will be with the late season hunting. Be safe, because it's that time.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, you summed her up pretty good there. I don't really have too much of a parting shot other than, you know, late season, as tough as it is, it can be extremely fruitful. And if you want birds for the wall, there's no better time to get them than late season. I mean, just last weekend, I had a beautiful pintail sprig, bull sprig. I didn't even see him until I went back and looked at my shot cam. He was 35 yards. His mallard was 25. I keyed in on that mallard. And I didn't even see them. There was a pair of them. They were coming right in. I mean, I wouldn't have shot him at 35, but he probably would have came in closer if I had seen him. And then I would be, you know, out. Well, I'd have a use for my tax refund, I guess. But
I'll show you the pintail on my wall then.
gosh, that's all I want is a nice big bull sprig. Every pintail I've ever shot hasn't had much of a sprig, if it's even had one. So
yeah, this is definitely the time of year to get your mountain ducks done. All my nice mountain ducks, the ones that I've got at the taxidermist right now, came out of late season or later season. Minus my Barrow's Goldeneye was in full colors up in Alaska that I sent to the taxidermist up there. But yeah, this is definitely the time of year to get your ducks, you know, that you want to put for the wall. So,
and your taxidermist will appreciate that too, because there's less likely to be any pin feathers this time of year.
Yeah, that's true too. So, all right. Well, you know, that's all I've got for this week in the late season, and I'll have hopefully more content coming up for the Brant hunt, the Chesapeake Bay diver hunt late season, and then also I have to talk to you about my new trophy mount idea that I'm pretty excited about. It's going to be a little bit different, but hopefully it works out. We'll see. I got the first part of it in the mail today. But we'll wrap that up in a later episode. So other than that, man, I've got nothing else. You want to close it out?
Yeah, I guess real quick, you know, I'm got a 5-day trip here for duck hunting planned, and we've got 55, 60 mile an hour winds the next 2 days. So like I said, you know, hunting those, that different change in weather, it was going from 64 today to 40 tomorrow. I'm kind of excited. I think this might be enough change to get whatever ducks in the area is hopefully to dump in. At least that's why I'm going out. So, other than that though, you know, we've got 2 weeks left in Nebraska. I'm looking really forward to closing it out strong and looking really forward to hearing how your Brant and Canvasback hunts go. Those are going to be a blast, hopefully, for you.
I'm excited. It's the highlight of my season so far, because up until now, it's been pretty slow.
All right. Save the best for last, but yeah, let's get out of here. And, I don't know. You want to take a shot at Ben real quick?
Hopefully Ben rediscovers his passion for duck hunting and joins us on future episodes of the Fowl Front Outdoors. Thomas is lost in Texas somewhere, actually shooting ducks. So it's good that he's got that scratching. And, you know, make sure you go to our Facebook page, like and subscribe. That thing's growing pretty well. It's a pretty happy community of tips and things that you need. Yeah, check that out. Give us a like. Oh,
What's the name of it?
Oh, the Fowl Front Outdoors Waterfowl Podcast Group. Anyways, it's not the Alex Wallace, you know, Facebook waterfowl group. So anyways, if you have any comments, critiques, leave those as well. We do take a look at them. And if you have any topic ideas you want to hear in the future, drop those in the Facebook group or message one of the admins, and we'll be happy to get it on there. So that being said, look forward to seeing you on future episodes of the Fowl Front Outdoors, and I'm out of here.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Fowl Front Waterfowl Podcast. Please come join us on our Facebook group, the Fowl Front Waterfowl Podcast group, where you can connect with a good group of hunters, because we're all in this together. We need to act like it so that hopefully our great, great grandkids will be hunting ducks over our favorite public lands. We also ask that you go ahead and give us a written review on iTunes and give us 5 stars if you think we deserve it. And we really do want to hear back from you so that we can give you the best possible content. And if you get in on that Facebook group, you can get in there and you can ask questions and you can tell us what you want to hear next, or you can tell us what you don't like, and we'll be sure to tailor things to our listeners. So, all right, stay safe out there, and we will see you next week.
Hey everyone, Will Cooper here, host of Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast. Join us as we dive deep into the world of hunting and outdoor pursuits. We've brought together some of the most accomplished individuals in the industry to share their invaluable insights and experiences with you. But here's the kicker. It's not just about hunting tips and tactics. We're exploring how you can carve your own path, elevate your skills, and gain some wisdom from the best in the field. So whether you're a seasoned hunter looking to fine-tune your skills, or a newbie eager to learn, our podcast has something for everyone. Stay tuned for more exciting guests and hotter topics. Don't miss out and subscribe to Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast today and start making your mark in the great outdoors. Four in the
morning, join me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew here at Duck Camp Dinners every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV. Birds up in the sky.